Well, one of the things I was very pleased to, first of all, thank you for the invitation. Very nice meeting you the other day. And I was very pleased when you told me that I'd be speaking to people who aren't painters because I don't get that opportunity too often. Just about everybody I know is a painter. And the first thing that I thought of is I'd just like to clear up a little misconception. And this might sound a little like Elizabeth Gilbert's TED talk, but artists are not, we're really not that unusual. We're not as unusual as Hollywood or literature might make you think. We're pretty actually normal. We lead normal lives. We're devoted to our work. Most of us teach. Most of us are married, have families. We connect really well with each other. We bond pretty quickly. And I actually felt that when I met you, Julianne, I felt like within a couple of minutes we were like old friends. I'm not sure if you're actually a painter or art historian.
I wish I were a painter. I've always wanted to be, but I was too lazy to like really work at it.
No, I mean they're two separate things. But this really there's where we're not these rebellious people living on the edge and self-destructive and all that. We're just really committed to our work. And but that said, we're also pretty sensitive. And when you spend your life just staring at things and trying to paint, you become super observant. So I would say that's the only difference. We may be a little more observant than the average folks, but other than that, not a big, not a big story, really. Just wanted to get that out of the way for whatever it's worth. And I just have to hit the continue button here. Okay, so so let me, is it okay if I do a screen share and share a few other images first?
Sure.
Yeah, because
And you're okay with us asking questions, right?
I love it, yes, right. So actually I'm screwing up already. I'm doing the wrong screen share. So let me just get back to this. Okay, so here's a painting that we were just talking about. Is that visible?
Yes.
Can you see this? Okay. So this is the biggest painting I've ever done, 72 by 90. It took about 4 years on and off. It was probably the best thing that ever happened to me career-wise. At the time, I was still in my 30s when I painted it, and this painting helped me break into the art world, to the gallery world. Juliana, you saw the piece in the gallery, sold a couple of years later. And in a lot of ways, it was also the worst thing that ever happened to me, because I was still kind of inexperienced with the art business, didn't really understand how it worked. And then suddenly, overnight, this big, high-powered New York City gallery wanted me to produce 10 of these. And as I just said, it took 4 years to produce this one and it almost killed me. And now they wanted a whole other series of these. And I actually tried to do that and I just completely burnt out and really lost interest in painting for a few months. So blessing and a curse at the same time. That's the biggest painting. This is the smallest painting, probably one of the smallest paintings. This is about a 5 by 7. And as you can see, it's much looser, it's a little abstract. And this was done in about 20 minutes. And I did this last night for my class. So it's really one extreme or the other. I'm either working very big and very ambitious, or working really small and loosely. So anyway, following that crisis that I just mentioned, this became my studio later. I left New York City. My wife and I decided, let's just get out, let's get away from the pressure. And we moved to the beautiful Catskill Mountains of New York State, about 2 hours north of New York City. And this is where I worked for the next 12 years, actually. The plan was to live, this was the gallery, actually. And there's another shot. The plan was to live here for 3, 4 years. We stayed for 12. That's how much we loved it. We had 5 acres of property, 3,000 square feet. It was just magical. And gradually sort of got my painting legs back and started producing again and got back in the game, but it took a while. It took many months to get, you know, to come back. So, you know, classic example, I guess, of be careful what you wish for. This is a joke. I think this group is too young to get this, but this is a sitcom from the 1970s about a Manhattan couple that leaves a city, moves to a farm for a better life, a simpler life. And what they find out is that life in the country is just as stressful, maybe more stressful, as life in the city. This is what we experienced as well. Because things happen, like tree falls on your studio. You know, once I found a dead deer at the front of my driveway blocking, and I couldn't get in and out of the driveway, didn't know what to do about it. So full of these little surprises. But then I started painting nature, I started painting the trees, the mountains, landscapes, and that became the body of work for quite a while. And I'll just run through these pretty quickly because I'm not really a landscape painter. The landscape is just too beautiful to paint, in my opinion. There's nothing to add to it, really. It's perfect the way it is, and I have nothing or very little to say about it, to add to it. But during that experience, this became my favorite tool. I started painting with a palette knife, which is a very different kind of painting than what you might think. The brush, the knife is a very powerful tool that gives you a lot of speed, and it gives the work a lot of freshness. If we have time, I'll show you a real quick clip of how that works. So I started painting with a knife. I painted this picture with a knife.
Good info for one of our students, Renat, who also says she paints with knives.
Oh, right, great. Renat? Yeah. That's Renat, good for you. Yeah, it's great, isn't it?
Yes, I really enjoy painting with knives.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's not as clumsy as you might think. It can give you some sensitivity. And you can scratch with it too. Let's see. Do I have detail? Yeah. So like if you get really in close, you know, those little strands of this nest, that's actually scratched out with a knife. It's not painted in. So it gives you all this nice texture to work with. I threw this in, and this is kind of a, you know, bits and pieces from some of the lectures I give, but I threw this in to show you really what the crux of painting is really about observation. It's not so much about technique. And if you can read that little caption, it says that square A and B are the same shade of gray, right? Looks impossible, but it really is. And this is because light and shade is kind of illusory. Sometimes you think something is light is really dark and the opposite. Sometimes you think a color is really bright. It isn't. It's actually quite dark. And this is what I spend most of my time struggling with, is trying to figure out exactly what I'm looking at. Right? So it's not about putting paint on canvas. It's about grasping the visual world and really understanding what you're seeing. Because there are illusions operating all the time. We're constantly seeing things, believe it or not, that aren't really there. And we also miss things, a lot of things that are there. And this is the basis of it. Okay. This is one of my favorite portraits in the world. This is Velázquez, Juan de Pareja. I didn't pronounce that perfectly, but most of my favorite artists are paint very simple scenes, ordinary people, nothing really grand, but a lot of truth to the work. Beautiful portrait. This is a still life by Van Gogh of his boots, which to me look like they're alive and they're about to get up and walk away. That's what I love about them. Yeah, and that really, so anyone has any questions, comments, just check. You don't have to.
Could I just ask you about what you meant when you said life was full of illusion? Illusions are everywhere. And for example, what would be an example of that?
Well, my classic example, my favorite example, are lines. really, outlines. Ask anyone who's never drawn before, or even someone who's kind of new, to draw something, and they will draw an outline of something, you know, a face, and then they'll fill in the color. But the amazing thing is there are no lines. There's no such thing as a line in nature. The only lines are the ones that people draw and paint. So that's like the classic illusion, outlines, right? So, you know, the reason people, most of humanity, thought the world was flat 400 years ago and earlier is because they looked out on the horizon and they saw a line out on the horizon, the ocean or the landscape, and they thought that that line was the end of the earth and you would just fall off. And we all know that it isn't. That horizon line that we see is really the place where the earth bends. It turns away from our view. And this is true of small things too. This is true, for example, of an apple. Right? What you think is the outline of an apple is really the place where that form turns away from your view over to the other side. So the point is, lines don't really exist. They're all in our minds. Another illusion is color. We tend to see a lot of color, but for painters, color is only one element. A much more important element is value, like I said in this example. Shades of light and dark are actually more important to a painter than color. So those are the two big ones.
Okay.
And a Cezanne painting, which I love, early Cezanne. Simple, just paintings of apples on a table. And this is Giorgio Morandi, 20th century Italian artist. So these guys influenced my work a lot, and you can see a little of that in this piece. Now, I went to art school for 4 years, and the most of what we did in art school was draw and paint the figure, nudes, portraits, things like that. 4 years, day in, day out, all day long, live models. Wonderful experience. I painted, studied in New York with a bunch of other kids. I studied under this guy, the man who painted this, named Ronald Scher, phenomenal portrait painter and teacher, living in Hong Kong now. And his main instruction was, number one, what I just said, observation, right? He used to say, look at your subject as if your life depended on it a lot. That was his thing. And the other thing he taught us was find a focal point. Find one area of your subject and give it 90% of your attention, and let the rest of it just drift off. So you see in this portrait, everything isn't developed equally. The face, especially the eyes, come into sharp focus, and everything else is sort of sketched, okay? That actually gives you a more lifelike appearance because that's how the eye sees. It doesn't take in everything equally. It focuses on one small area and everything else you see peripherally. And just a couple more heroes, John Singer Sargent. Ilya Repin, wonderful Russian painter. This is an early portrait. I did this in 1991, life-size portrait. I see a lot of clumsiness in the portrait now, but at the time I was proud of it. It's a later portrait of a good friend, charcoal and graphite. One little thing you can see, she's wearing a white blouse on a white background. That puts her head in focus. All of the contrast, all in detail is up in her face, which I want the viewer to pay attention to. Another portrait, I made a living as a portrait artist for a few years. Found it to be a really demanding a way to make a living. So didn't stay with it for too long, but learned a lot from it. I'm just gonna skip through. This is another favorite artist, Lucian Freud. This is another portrait commission. Okay, this is actually part of this, a self-portrait, 1998. I know why I did the sequence, because I wanted to show that, you know, Chuck Close's paintings, you can see, even though they look realistic, they're really made up of pieces of color. Right. You get up close and it's totally out of focus. And I realize the same thing is true with realist painters. If you get up close to the self-portrait, you can see it just falls apart. It's just smudges of charcoal in certain places. Okay, so leading up to the painting we discussed, this is 1992 charcoal sketch of the loft where I lived. Now, when I left art school, I had this crisis of not having models to paint anymore and didn't know what to paint. So what a lot of us do when we're younger, we either do a lot of self-portraits or we paint each other, but that gets old after a while. So I had nothing left to paint except my surroundings. So I did the interiors, I did my art materials. I did this old chair that my cats tore to shreds. And that led me to, there's a detail of that charcoal drawing. Old radiator. And that led me to this piece. So it was this progression. It was art school and then being alone in my studio and painting the walls and the floors and the ceilings and eventually moving to this place. And this became the work. So Julia, I'm going to stop for a second and ask if there's anything I can add to this.
So are there any questions? I'm hoping to hear more of your voices.
You must have there questions. Was, yes. The one that you mentioned where you said, like, now you can see a lot of clumsiness in it. Like, I'm not an artist at all. So, you know, to me, I don't see where you would see clumsiness. So do you think that's because you feel or you remember making it and maybe your technique has progressed, so you kind of look back and think, this is what I could have done? Or, and like, for example, or so that's your experience, but can you look at somebody else's art and think, that looks a little clumsy because your eye is more trained?
Great question. One of the, I guess, the paradox or the irony of being an artist is that as you learn and as you develop, your standards become higher. So what you thought was great in your student days, you learn, your technique gets better, but really your eye gets better. Your eye actually changes over time. Your vision actually improves. And I don't mean in the sense of 20/20 vision. My actual vision is not as good as it was when I was in my 20s. You know, I wear glasses now. But the ability to process visual information, the ability to understand what I'm seeing has gotten so much better since then. So yeah, I see clumsiness. I see things that look a little, hesitant. There's more timidity. There's less confidence in the stroke. The colors and the tones are not as refined. You know, things are a little more blunt. And I'll go into that further in a minute, what I mean. I don't want to get too technical, but that's the challenge. As you get better, as you get more experience, you want more. Your standards become higher. So you're never really satisfied. There's always this gap between what you can do and what you want to do. But you know, I don't look at other people's work as critically as I look at my own either. I actually like looking at student work, and I see mostly positive stuff when I look at it.
Can I ask whether you ever sketched, made a drawing of this scene that we're looking at here, or was it just bits and pieces and then you just created the oil painting?
No, actually I did a lot of sketches, and I'm sorry I don't have any sketches to show you. That would have been helpful, but no, I probably did at least a dozen sketches of this before painting it. Sketching is like a warm up, you know, you just get a feel for the subject answer the question, you know, well, do I really want to paint this or not? And if within 10 minutes of sketching, if I'm bored, then I know I'm not going to go the distance with a painting. So I'll just scrap it and try a different angle or a different subject. So sketching is really helpful. Just about every artist sketches before they launch into the final piece. But you know, this is a place I lived and worked here. It was great because I lived with my work for all this time. A lot of artists have separate studios, usually commercial spaces that they commute to like a job. And they swear by that because there's fewer distractions and they can focus on the work. I've always liked to live where I work because things pop up, like little surprises, like, you know, like a coffee cup on the table and a little bowl there. I didn't plan that. It was just there. And I decided it would be fun to capture. Off in the kitchen area, you can see like this little bowl. That's where my cat's dish was, you know, in the corner. Again, didn't plan it. It was just there.
That does beg another question, though. the whole idea of staging a scene before painting it. So how much of the staging was present in the sketches, and you know, where did the transformation happen between the sketches and the final? Like, did many things change? Many details change?
Well, again, it's going back a few years. You know, I started this in 1996, right? 1996 to 2000. So, you know, it's going back a ways, but none of it is staged. I don't really stage anything because I hate that look. But things did find their way into the painting. So like I started it, the table might have been empty. I don't remember when I started it. And then maybe after a few weeks, someone left the newspaper there and the cup there, and I decided, oh, that'll be nice to put in there. So it's a little bit of planning, but it's also being open to whatever changes in the scene and the work. I'm really one thing I've really learned how to do a lot of editing in the work. So I don't do that much planning, but I've gotten pretty good at making changes. That's maybe not an easy thing for non-painters to understand, but paintings go through a lot of changes, almost like a manuscript or like a film. There's a lot of editing that goes on in a painting. And it's not as difficult or as painful as you might think. Oil paint is fairly opaque. So if you want to change something, all you have to do is cover that area with some fresh paint. It disappears, and then you paint something else on top of it, or you just leave it the way it was.
And how do you know when it's done?
You know, you never know. You never know. And it's always, always this feeling like I could have done more. I could have done better. Shouldn't have done this. Shouldn't have done that. Painting is never. It's never quote unquote done. But you do eventually run out of steam and you lose your energy and your enthusiasm. And that's just time to let go.
And then it gets acquired by a museum.
That can happen, yeah. I actually don't remember the sequence, but I was in a lot of trouble with this too, because this painting was so big that I couldn't get it out of the narrow staircase of where I lived. I had a narrow second floor staircase and I could not get it down the stairs. It was impossible. So I had to take apart one of my big studio windows, slide it out diagonally, and then lower it to the ground with a rope, and then put the window back together before my landlord came back and got furious. So once the painting was out, it was out. There was no going back. And it was just fortunate that it was acquired while it was on exhibition. So a little bit of luck there. Another little technical thing, little artist thing. There's a lot of variety in warm and cool. That's another thing that we think of a lot. So the floor itself is mostly warm. A lot of golden and red tones, but if you get a little closer, you look at the highlights, they're sort of bluish, right? The light in the distant area is kind of bluish. The walls are kind of cool. So it's good to have that balance in a painting, warm and cool. as far as color goes, you know, it's good to, it's just more, less is actually more. It's good to hold back a little bit. If you saturate your paintings with too much color, they just look, they look garish and they're too hard on the eyes. I hope I'm not getting too technical here with all this painter stuff.
No, it's really interesting. It's like an exercise in looking. I love when you zoom into your pictures because it sort of brings us in and enables us to see what you're talking about, these little variations of shade and so on.
Yeah, and that's how we paint. We basically start with a big rough layout and then we work sections, smaller sections at a time. Sometimes sometimes I might spend an entire day on one small area and just not even look at the rest of the piece. So I guess that's why I like the zooming in a lot.
Yeah.
There's a close up. And at some point I decided the focus of the painting would be the floor. I just loved the way the light was hitting that floor. Mm-hmm. It just glowed, but it was an old place. The floors were seriously beat up and they had all this great texture and this great detail. Couple influences. This is Wilhelm Hammershøi, great Danish painter, 20th century. You can see, you know, sort of a connection there. Andrew Wyeth, American artist. Wyeth is a master of surfaces, in my opinion. And I think I got that love of surfaces from him. He was a big deal in the 1980s when I was an art student. Andrew Wyeth was at the top of the list, top of his game, and we couldn't get enough of his work. This is a later painting. I decided to do another version, but I wanted this version to be emptier. So I took just about everything out of the next room, and I just painted space with very few objects in it. The area outside this window, I'm going to zoom in again for you. The area outside the window actually had a lot more clarity to it. It wasn't this hazy. But if I painted it that way, it wouldn't have the depth. That outside space, that house across the street would come right through the window actually, and it would flatten the painting out. So realist paintings have these two conflicting goals. We try to paint the world exactly as we see it, but sometimes you have to make changes. Sometimes you have to alter reality slightly to create a decent painting. And it's not always easy to know when. And there's a detail of that floor. It's another painting I did around that time. This is my studio windows, which were pulled out of the studio by my landlord. And I just love the look of them. I stacked them against the wall and I painted them. I started working on this just a little before 9/11 when the planes hit the Trade Towers. I was actually painting this picture. And the news, you know, the horrible news was coming in through the television. My wife had the television on. And I didn't want to listen to the news because it was so horrible and heartbreaking. So I just kept working on this painting. It was a distraction. It's the only thing that kept me from completely losing it. And worked on this painting for the next probably about 6 months after that. But unlike the others, this is a shallow piece. There's only about 3 feet of actual space in this composition. It's flat. But that little reflection in the window, a reflection of a window in a window, gives the appearance of space, something, another world out there in the distance. And there's a detail. And I got into this thing called single object still lives, simply one object on a table all by itself, and spent a few years painting these little guys. Another favorite artist of mine, William Nicholson. William Nicholson. Great British artist, mid-20th century. Also a master of simplicity. And muted color, gracious color. Okay, just a few paintings of glass. Glass is wonderful to paint. It's also, it also really connects with people. I find the glass paintings to be pretty popular. Simple still life. Probably done in about an hour or so. A charcoal drawing, charcoal and graphite on paper. I use charcoal and pencil sort of the way I use paint. Just mostly work tonally. Again, I said outlines don't really exist. There really aren't any outlines in this piece either. It's mostly done with changes in tone, changes in light and dark. Let's see, I don't want to go on too long because I'd like to be able to show a very quick video if I can. Yeah, I think I'll just stop there for now because this is a much longer presentation than I think you have time for.
It's so nice. It's so beautiful.
Thank you.
Really enjoying it.
Well, that's good. Well, we can come back to it. So you guys, have any, you know, I don't want to dominate the whole conversation. You guys have any comments, questions, or anything? Yeah, go ahead.
Everybody wants to say something.
Great. No, please.
You want to go? Okay.
I'm old world, so ladies first.
I don't know if it's like a cliche question, but what's your favorite and least favorite medium to work with? And is there anything new you'd want to try out?
Great. No, good question. My favorite medium is oil. Oils on canvas, oils on panel. I sometimes work on canvas for the big works, panels for smaller works. Strictly oil. I've never worked in any other medium. Mm-hmm. And for the drawings, it's charcoal and graphite. Graphite is like, you know, the pencils we use in school. We used to use in school, regular pencils. Graphite on paper. I like to draw on watercolor paper because it's really high quality. It can take some punishment, so you can work on it for a long time without the paper going bad on you. Oil paints are just wonderful. They have this reputation for being difficult. They're not. The wonderful thing about oil paints is the range of them. You can use them in all kinds of ways. You can go really thin, like a watercolor, or you can go really heavy. It's like almost like you're doing sculpture. And all sorts of thicknesses in between. So you can be bold, subtle, you know, anything. That's the wonderful thing about them. And the colors are just amazing and rich. And the downside to them is they, you know, they're a little fragile. You have to be careful with how you store them and how you treat them. And, you know, they're not as durable as, say, acrylic. But that's it. Those are my two mediums. And I've gotten to know them really well. So it takes a lot of the guesswork out of the process. I don't have to wonder what's going to happen. I know exactly what's going to happen before I do it. So.
Okay. Thank you.
The gentleman had a question.
Yeah, I do your website, and you have a painting named 10th Avenue Stopline, something like that?
Yeah, 10th Avenue Crosswalk, yeah.
Crosswalk, exactly. I was wondering, it's so precise. Is it like a cross line you saw every day, or was it once and it marked you so much that you would decided to paint it afterwards?
It's near where I live, so it's something I see every day or just about every day. And if you know anything about New Yorkers, we tend to really mind our own business. You know, we tend to just, we're either preoccupied or thinking about something. But if you ever watch New Yorkers, we're on the street, we're always looking down, right? We're always looking down at what is directly in front of us, the pavement, whatever. And I notice that in myself. When I go somewhere, my head is down and I'm looking 10 feet in front of me. And then I realize that I look at the street that way too. When I cross the street, I'm not looking up at the buildings, I'm looking down at the street. And that's how I got the idea for that series. Just what what does the pavement, the sidewalk, the crosswalk in front of me look like? So I wanted to capture New York City without the cliches of buildings, skyscrapers, statues, you know, the icons. I wanted to capture the feeling of New York the way most of us actually see it. So that was the impetus behind that series. It's much more difficult than I thought it would be because there's nothing really solid in any of those compositions. It's just texture and changes in light and shade, but that's how it grew. Anybody else?
I have a question about camera obscuras. Are these helpful when one is learning how to paint or draw, or are they a hindrance? Just sort of wondering, because a lot of people talk about how they can be helpful, but maybe not. What do you think?
Yeah. I have no direct experience with camera obscura, so I can't really say. I know when I was in school, working from life was really pushed on us. You know, you've got to learn how to paint from life first before you do anything else. And I think that was good advice. It really taught us how to see things in a three-dimensional way. It kept us from getting too tight, too linear, too soon. So my advice would be to a student, yeah, stay away from photography for as long as you can. And then when you get some experience, it's probably okay. But I don't know anything about camera obscura because I know the masters used them a lot. Vermeer used it, Velazquez and such, but you probably know more about camera obscura than I do.
No, but you occasionally hear in the media, you know, we hear a lot of stuff through the media, but like David Hockney used camera obscura. It's just been revealed. Scandal, you know, like he's a cheater for doing this. As if the artist had manipulated his viewers somehow, you know, as if there had been some trickery, which is totally ridiculous, of course. It's kind of a nasty thing to say. But
yeah, I mean, it is, and it isn't. I mean, like, it isn't a nice thing to say, but the thing about working from photography is I don't think it's cheating because you're not really fooling anybody. Paintings that are done from photography always look a certain way. And I do some painting from photography, and it always has a certain look to it. And then paintings done from life have a different look to them, and you can't mistake it either, anyone who looks at art. So it's not really cheating because no one really gets away with it. And I don't mean get away with it in a negative sense. I mean, it's just a different look. So if you want that really atmospheric, really three-dimensional look, you should probably work from life. And if you're more into the detail, or if you're doing photorealism, then there's not a thing wrong with working from photography. Both take a lot of skill. You know, cameras really do distort things. They leave out a lot of information. They tend to sharpen up too much because camera just has one eye. Human beings have two, so we see things in a softer way. But I don't have any issues, personal issues with that kind of thing. But I don't know. I'm not sure if I answered your question, but
yeah, no, it's just interesting to know your thoughts on that.
I mean, some of the photorealists, what they do is just completely amazing. Whether they work from photos or not, it's just completely amazing what they can do. Just blows me away. But it's a different look, you know. It's kind of slick, and it doesn't really have the motion of the atmosphere of a... Anyway. Anybody else? Any other question?
I was really struck by the painting of the nest that you had done with the palette knife.
Thank you. Yeah.
I've never been able to make lines that were that thin with a palette knife, and so I was wondering, I guess two things. What medium did you use, and did you use a thinning medium as well?
Yeah, sure. Well, let's see. Let me see if I can get it back on the screen so it'll make a little more sense when I talk about it. So
Oh, and also, sorry, one more thing.
No, don't be sorry.
Did you do it in a bunch of layers? Did it take a while to, because there's a lot of strokes that are really fine and detailed. Did it take a while for the paint to dry to layer it up, or?
This dried pretty quickly because I did it in the spring and the summer. It was pretty warm, and it's done on a panel. So paintings on panel tend to dry a little faster. And, you know, when I say palette knife, it doesn't mean 100% palette knife. It's probably, you know, 75% knife work and a little bit of brush work here and there. But I use the knife for scraping. And also, when you turn the knife to the side, and maybe I'll try to show you real quickly on the video how to use the knife. But when you turn the knife to the side and you use just the edge of it, I wish I had a knife in front of me, you can get some really sharp details, sharper than anything you can get with a brush. It's just a matter of knowing how to use it. Or sometimes you'll use the knife to take paint off, mm-hmm. and the dark part of the panel will come through, and that looks like a detail. So the knife can really be a sensitive and can be a really precise tool. But I always use some brush too. Almost never paint exclusively with a knife, especially with a detailed piece like this. And I did use some medium. I used liquid medium, which is I don't even know what it is anymore, but it has some varnish in it, and it also speeds the drying, and it really thins down the paint. Also use sandpaper to get some texture in it. Right, you can see how rough it is, really. If you get up close, you can see how, you know, it's really pretty rough in a lot of places. And these twigs or these strands, they don't all connect with each other. They're broken up. So like, I'm going to use my little annotation tool here. So for example, this one right here, this line, it loops around. Sorry, let me just give me a second here. So it loops around like this. And then it disappears a little bit, and then it reappears down here, same one. And then you can't really see this, but then it kind of reappears here. So when you're doing something with a lot of detail, and especially things that are linear, it's really a good idea to break the lines up and not have them continual. Here's another one like this detail, and then it stops, and then it picks up again here. So there's this little gap in between. That little gap is important. That gap, it gives the eye a rest, number one, the eye of the viewer. And it actually creates a stronger connection with the viewer than if it was continual. Because you, the viewer, fill in the gap. And when you fill in the gap, when you fill in the missing information with your imagination or your experience, it resonates and it becomes stronger and you're actually participating in the illusion. Long-winded explanation to describe how bringing the viewer into the work is really helpful. You end up suggesting more detail than you're actually doing. So this thing looks really detailed from a distance. It's not. It's just a lot of bits and pieces, and you guys are putting it together for me. A lot of it. So any other questions?
Art historians are kind of, you know, they're weirdos basically who create story. You know, they look at this, you know, they create movements or, you know, periods of art. We've been talking about periodization last week and this week, and you know, we use labels to enable ourselves to talk about something and the evolution of something. And you sort of create a timeline for a class, and then you sort of look back critically at it, because timelines are extremely dissatisfying because you're inevitably labeling things and putting things into boxes and talking about things as if they evolve in a developmental way, in a, you know, in a progressive way somehow. Of course, that's not the case, but one might be inclined to think so when you sort of look through an art history book that tells a story through time. And I was just wondering about your, you know, this thing we call style. How did you decide? How did you know that you wanted to become a realist? Or would you call yourself a realist? Are you okay with that label? How are there realisms? Could you talk about sort of the style and the way you think about your style in relation to other people's similar styles, other people's realisms, if that makes sense?
I don't know how that happened. I just self-muted somehow. Well, just from my own perspective, I can't speak for other realists or other artists at all, but it really just came down to doing what came most naturally to me. I actually flirted with abstraction a little bit, but I wasn't very good at it. And I tried to be an illustrator, and I tried to be a photorealist. You know, I tried a few different things and just eventually settled on what I enjoyed the most and what just came most naturally. And I think it's important for any artist to just do what, you know, do what is most natural to them. Otherwise, it doesn't resonate. If you're trying to be something you're not, it just doesn't resonate. So it wasn't even a decision. It was just gravitating towards a certain thing and the kind of art I responded to in museums. And when we go to art school, you know, there's all kinds of teachers we can study with, and they usually show the work of the teachers in the catalogs, and we all pick the teachers who are doing the kind of art that we like. So they're all different kinds of teachers. I studied with a realist. I showed you his work before. I just loved his work. So he taught me what he knew, and I became a realist. But it wasn't really a decision. It was just more of an intuitive thing, really. I'm not a big intellectual. I don't really think things through a lot. And so that's really, as far as the art history and some of the commentary and the criticisms, I think it's fine. I just don't participate in it that much.
So. You spoke earlier about the sort of pressure that the gallery, you know, that sort of, you spoke about the painting that I've been hailing as sort of the biggest aesthetic, one of the biggest aesthetic experiences of my life as a curse. So I'm a little bit embarrassed now because, you know, you must have mixed feelings about this painting now. But you spoke about the gallery's, you know, your experience of this gallery and the pressure it created, the pressure it had on you as an artist, and that made you feel uncomfortable and you sort of wanted to get away. So I guess what I'm asking is, you know, did it take a while for you to sort of build yourself up again? And did that sort of reconnecting with yourself as an artist happen in the Catskills through nature, or how did you manage to sort of bounce back from that experience?
No, and that's a good question. No, I mean, I don't mean to give the impression that looking at this painting is a painful experience for me or anything. It's not. I have great memories of this painting, and I'm really happy the way it turned out. It actually almost sold to a private collector before it sold to the museum. So I'm grateful that first sale fell through. It could have gone a lot worse, because when work goes into a private collection, it just disappears into someone's home, and it's usually never seen again unless the collector donates it. So the fact that this went to a museum and a lot of people get to see it, I'm thrilled about that. And this museum is wonderful. They really were generous in sharing it with other museums. They've kept it on the walls practically the whole time. So this painting's been on view for almost 20 a little over 20 years. So I'm really, really grateful for that. What happened, what I was describing was a little too much success, a little too soon, mm-hmm. a little too much success, a little too fast. You know, most artists, they go from art school, okay, and then they start showing in small galleries, small towns, and college galleries, and they gradually work their way up. It didn't happen to me. I went from total obscurity to this big New York City gallery virtually overnight, and I just wasn't ready for it. So that was the thing, and I just couldn't keep up with the demands. So yeah, we moved to the country, and I started teaching again for the first time in about 5-6 years, and that was great. Got back involved with other artists and connected with nature, as you said, and had a great studio, and you know, it was just a really healthy experience away from New York City. And yeah, gradually got productive again, and started with another gallery in a different city, Philadelphia, actually, a family-owned gallery, more my speed, more comfortable, and so it worked out. It was just a setback that lasted about 6 months, not a big deal.
Okay, and do you show your work regularly in this gallery in Philadelphia, or is this the place to see your work, or?
No, right now the only place to see my work is online. I was with that gallery for another 6 years, and since my last gallery representation was 2016, and I've been just showing my work online and having an online career since then. So the place to see my work is online, is on my website, and our whole art world is turning virtual now. So
right,
happy with that. Happy with that change.
How is it to have an online kind of persona and artwork shown online? How does that work as an artist? Are you ever scared that people will steal your ideas? Because that's something that we're going to talk about in this class too, right? Since now the world is turning digital.
Yeah. Yeah, there's, yeah, I think I'm starting to see a lot of paintings out there online that look a little like my own younger artists doing, and I find them incredibly flattering. I don't feel like they're stealing the ideas. Maybe now and then I think, hey, you know, but no, I think it's great. And you can't really steal an artist's ideas. We all have our own touch and our own way of seeing things. I mean, with the classes that I teach, I tell people exactly how I paint. I show them the materials, I give demonstrations, and no matter how carefully I explain it, everything they do is always going to be a little different. So it's really almost impossible to completely duplicate the work of another artist. It's never quite the same. So I don't worry about that too much. I like online marketing. I like having a website. I blog a lot, and I'm okay with technology. So, I don't know if
clearly
I said,
you've got two screens here. So yeah.
I've become a bit of a geek, actually.
Does anybody else have any questions? Amanda does.
How was your painting discovered? Because if it was in your home, because you said it only really left your home when you, when the gallery bought it.
Yeah, this particular gallery saw my work elsewhere, other works, two directors of this gallery, and they came to my studio. I did a studio visit, and the painting was finished. It was in my studio, and they selected a few works for a group show. This was in the year 2000. So they came to me.
Okay.
You know, they came over.
So where was your work previously then that they saw?
Oh, well, yeah, it was in an exhibition at the art school where I studied. It was an alumni exhibition.
Oh, okay.
And the title of the exhibition was 20/20, 20 works by 20 alumni, It's a great show. And this gallery wandered, this directors of this gallery wandered into that show. They saw my stuff there, and then they came to my studio.
Oh, I see. Okay.
It was a huge leap. It was a small exhibition at an art school, and then boom, overnight to this big
gallery. So is that how it usually works? That especially if it's someone that hasn't been all that discovered yet, and how do their work gets discovered by small galleries or because they have small showings or?
Yeah. Actually being discovered, quote unquote, is really uncommon.
Okay.
It's really unusual. It's like you hear stories of people being discovered, actors, models, art. It's really uncommon. And that was the other thing that made this a shock. Usually artists build their careers slowly. So back in the day, we showed slides, 35 millimeter slides, which I don't know if anybody knows what those are, but those are like little, yeah. We showed slides. Yeah, we used to send, I never know what, we used to send slides to galleries of our work, samples of it with a resume, artist statement, description of our work. We would send those to galleries and they would look them over. And if they liked the work, they would schedule a studio visit.
Okay.
And then if they liked what they saw, then they would maybe put you in a group show, a small group. So that, and it still works that way, except now you don't send slides, you send digital images to the gallery. So that's how you get your work out there.
Mm-hmm.
And usually start small and then you work your way up.
So it's really interesting. I had no idea how it worked. So
no, a lot of people don't. A lot of people outside of the art business, and a lot of artists don't even know how it works. But yeah, you send samples, and it's a real long shot because galleries are flooded with submissions. Mm-hmm. They get dozens of them every week, and they just don't have time to look at them. So just getting a gallery to look at your submission is a big deal. But to get one gallery to come to your studio, take your paintings, and you know, that's like being struck by lightning.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Thank you.
Sure.
That kind of has to do with something I was wondering. Is it a process then to take like a photograph of your painting? Cause obviously it changes. You have to try for it to like not change an essence of your work. Right. So especially online as well. Cause I noticed this, we had a project where we had to recreate ourselves as an artwork, and sometimes paintings would look different depending what site I looked at, because somehow the color looked different or even the light of it. Is that quite a hard process to try to really capture what you had created?
Yeah, it's photographing a work of art is an art itself. I was lucky and I don't know where I got the wisdom for this, but right away hired a professional photographer to photograph my stuff, because paintings, they take on a lot of glare if you don't light them the right way. The colors get thrown off. They have to be square. So it really is a difficult process photographing paintings, especially big ones. So right from the start, I hired a pro. He was great. He gave me great prices because he was he eventually became a friend and he was an artist himself. But I spent like every penny I had on art photography when I was starting out. Excuse me, I just need a little water. I spent tens of thousands of dollars on art photography when I started out, and I was broke. I couldn't even afford it, but I knew it was important. So I always tell emerging artists, don't photograph your own work. Get a professional to do it if you can. It's well worth the expense. If you're, of course, not an artist, it's difficult. It's a difficult process to photograph any kind of art. There's information online that you can find. One tip is to try to light the paintings or the works from the side, from two angles. So try to get two lights, one on either side, 45 degree angle, and you point the light at an angle. That's helpful. Don't light it directly because it'll just become like a mirror and it'll just bounce the light the light right back at you.
Thanks for answering all our questions.
You're welcome.
We're keeping you a little bit longer than what I said. Okay. Class ends in 5 minutes, so if you have time, we might have time for one last question if anybody wants to ask it.
Perfect timing because my voice is starting to go. So.
And you have to get on with your day.
Yeah, that too. I actually have a class later in the afternoon.
Well, maybe just one last question for me, if nobody else has any, is what's it like to teach art online, a painting class?
Yeah, it's great. I love teaching online. I've been doing it ever since the pandemic. So early March, one of my schools just closed the doors and they went online. And the great part was they trained us. They taught us how to use Zoom. So we all learned pretty quickly. And within months, it became a big hit. And I get to teach artists from all over the country, all of the US, some from other countries. It's great. It's a lot more work because you have to actually give a presentation and you have to, you know, have a sequence and create slides, create videos maybe. Live classes, you just kind of stroll in and everyone paints and you just make corrections on the canvas or make suggestions. But with Zoom classes, it's work. But the upshot is you have a library. If you record it, or even if you just hold on to the images, you have content now that you can share later. So sometimes I'll repurpose a class and give it to another group. So that's the advantage as well. But I like it. I really enjoy it. The other reason, and I said this to you the other day, is I don't like interrupting people while they're painting with a critique, because I feel that's, I don't know, it's an interruption. Painting is a very, you know, it's kind of a private activity, and there's a state of mind there that I don't like to interrupt. It doesn't happen with a Zoom class.
Mm-hmm. So. Well, thank you. Do you have any students from outside the US?
Not at the moment, but I've taught people, I've had students from Australia, from Canada. I think I had one from Belgium. So gradually more and more international students are starting to come. The problem is the time difference. So it's not always easy to get people from other countries, but they're great. I love the international students, and they have a lot to offer in terms of their comments and their insights. Not that I have anything against Americans, but it's just nice having that. It's nice having that variety.
Well, we have a new president now, so it's not so bad anymore.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. I had a kind of a low turnout. I had class last night, and there's only half, I think, everyone was watching the inauguration.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your time and for sharing your work with us and for answering our questions. It's been really a dream come true, literally.
Oh, no, it's my pleasure. And thank you all. It's great meeting you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a great rest of your day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.